Hello my friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is February 27, 1978, and this is my audio letter number 31. Before I discuss anything else today, I want to take a moment to thank all of you who have been writing, sending news clippings, and your specially made tape recordings. My mail has become so overwhelming that it's physically impossible for me to answer most of you personally. But I do want you to know that even those things which I may not acknowledge for some time are read. The clippings, the tapes, and other personal tips you send me are studied, and it's all very helpful and appreciated, and I thank you again. The task of sorting out and analyzing the intelligence I receive nowadays from sources worldwide is a full-time job for me. On the other hand, the United States intelligence community, which employs more than 100,000 persons to do the analyzing for the government, costs the taxpayers billions of dollars a year. And moreover, the United States intelligence establishment is hamstrung at the top by over-centralization and a politicized analysis process that has produced a disastrous intelligence gap for America. So today, I receive a continuing flood of high-level intelligence from sources who believe you and certain other top officials worldwide should know. From time to time, I refer you to other sources of important information so that you can broaden your perspective or get further details. Sometimes these other sources return the favor by expressing very uncomplimentary opinions about me personally, and some of you have written to me greatly shocked over this. But, my friends, I ask you not to lose heart at a few ugly words when they appear. Instead, look beyond them to the facts that are documented. Compare those to my warnings and then decide for yourself. There are some who say I should keep quiet about the things I tell you, that I am frightening the people. But, my friends, if I did keep quiet, it would be like an air raid warden who refused to turn on the siren to warn of approaching bombers, because that would frighten people. And there are those who say I will ruin my credibility by revealing even hard intelligence about matters that depart so far from popular beliefs. But in the words of General George Keegan, recently retired Chief of Air Force Intelligence, quote, "I'd rather be right than credible," unquote. 5 years ago, I described in detail how the United States dollar would be destroyed deliberately and lead to monetary chaos. It seemed incredible, or as David Rockefeller put it, quote, "interesting science fiction," unquote. But today the dollar is following the so-called incredible course I warned about in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, and all the comfortable, credible monetary projections of that day are in the trash bin. Stagflation is confiscating our assets as it was planned to do. The intelligence I am revealing today is every bit as solid as that which I made public 5 years ago, and which is proving true today. But because you still are not being told the truth by the federal government or by the controlled major media, which gives me the silent treatment, the intelligence I make public leaves many people shaking their heads, just as they did 5 years ago. There have been many over the years who have warned that someday, if we didn't watch out, the Soviet Union would outstrip the United States militarily. Now someday has arrived. The Soviet Union has achieved dramatic military superiority over the United States, and we are in mortal danger. Now people are asking, what can we do? My friends, in December 1975, over 2 years ago, I recorded an entire one-hour talking tape entitled, What We Can Do to Save America, in order to acquaint you with some of the things every American citizen could do. And periodically in my audio letter tape series, I have made specific suggestions about things you could do under our Constitution to help bring our outlaw government back under our control. But now more than ever, the most important thing you can do is to help to bring about total public exposure of the facts of our terrible predicament. Don't expect the controlled major media to do it. They're doing all they can to prevent this exposure because they are being used to control your thinking, not honestly inform you. The time left to us to spread the alarm is very short indeed. For reasons I will explain today, Our secret rulers now believe they may have as much as 2 to 3 years in which to devise an effective response to the present overwhelming Soviet military might. As I will also explain, they are wrong. But in any case, you and I have very little time left before wartime controls and restrictions start binding and gagging us all. My three topics for today are Topic number 1, the dawning of Soviet cosmostrategy and cosmopolitics. Topic number 2, the accelerating build-up to a national emergency. And Topic number 3, growing casualties in the secret war over SALT. Topic number 1. In my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, I describe the new imperialism of the International Rockefeller Empire. It's an imperialism in which economic power of multinational corporations and banks, monetary manipulation, and big money politics are used to control entire nations and to reap the profits of East-West trade. The techniques of econo-strategy and econo-politics are the means by which great economic might are translated into the domination of others. These techniques are powerful, but they now face an unprecedented challenge. For in recent months, the Soviet Union has suddenly burst into the world arena with its new techniques of cosmo-strategy and cosmo-politics. In these techniques, unlike those of the Rockefeller establishment, money is a very secondary factor, important as a tool but nothing more. And in the newly unveiled Soviet approach to world domination, the Earth is viewed basically from the perspective of space, the cosmos. The new era of Soviet cosmostrategy and cosmopolitics dawned in earnest 5 months ago on September 27, 1977, and our secret masters are still reeling from the shock. On that day, with the first two operational Soviet killer satellites called Cosmos Interceptors in orbit, America lost the first full-fledged space battle in history. The secret American moon base in Copernicus Crater was to have been the ultimate ace in the hole for the Rockefellers in the coming war, armed with powerful beam weapons able to strike the Earth. But in the Battle of the Harvest Moon, the moon base was put out of action by Cosmos 954, the Soviet killer satellite that crashed in Canada last month on January 24. Using a neutron beam weapon, Cosmos 954 killed the entire crew of the Copernicus moon base with a stream of deadly neutron radiation. Our rulers got their first taste of the new Soviet Cosmos strategy that same day, September 27, 1977. After a very harsh speech against the United States and the United Nations, Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko demanded and got a hastily arranged, unusual evening meeting at the White House with Jimmy Carter and Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. Breathless reporters assured us that there had been a breakthrough in the SALT negotiations, and thereby painted this rush-rush meeting as a good thing. But as I told you in AUDIO LETTER 26, the only real breakthrough that had occurred was the Soviet breakthrough in the awesome particle beam weapon. Gromyko's message at the White House was an ultimatum to begin the process of surrender by disarming America under the guise of SALT II. In Topic number 3, I'll bring you up to date on the current status of the struggle over SALT surrender. The Kremlin is playing a deadly game of chess in its bid for world conquest. In any chess game, moves are planned far in advance, in sequence, according to careful strategy. They're not simply made in isolation. And so it was with the Battle of the Harvest Moon last September. The particle beam weapons which are now in orbit on Soviet Cosmos interceptor satellites are the product of a 10-year crash program. But other crash programs have been underway as well in the Soviet Union ever since the Soviet humiliation in the Cuban Missile Crisis 15 years ago. The plan was to develop in total secrecy a spectrum of new super weapon systems which, taken all together, would leapfrog past the capabilities of the United States. They were to be developed, tested, produced in the numbers required for operational deployment, and when ready, held in constant readiness for massive deployment when the time came. That time came 5 months ago. On September 27, 1977, the Soviet Union dealt the United States a staggering blow, unknown to the public at large because the government refuses to tell you about it. And just 2 days later, the Soviet manned space program began making spectacular headlines after years seemingly in eclipse. On that day, the Salyut 6 space station was launched, the same space station whose crew are rapidly closing in on America's space endurance record of 84 days. America's moon era had just ended, but that of the Soviet Union was about to begin. Meanwhile, Russia was adding rapidly to its fleet of operational Cosmos interceptor killer satellites. The two that I mentioned in AUDIO LETTER 26 were joined by 6 more in October 1977. And as of now, there are over 30 Soviet Cosmos interceptors orbiting the Earth, all of them manned and all of them armed with particle beam weapons. On October 4, 1977, Defense Secretary Harold Brown shocked reporters by confirming part of what I had already revealed in AUDIO LETTER No. 26, namely that the Soviet Union had achieved an operational killer satellite capability. But by refusing to explain how they work, Dr. Brown succeeded in misleading the reporters into presuming that the Soviet killer satellites work by gliding up next to their target and then exploding. By now, this concept is widely accepted as if it were fact, which it is not. But earlier this month, on February 2, 1978, Dr. Brown almost told Congress the truth. He said that the Soviet laser-firing killer satellite, already operational, will be substantially improved by the mid-1980s. My friends, a laser is a beam weapon, so Dr. Brown has now contradicted the assumption that the Soviet killer satellites are of the old explosive type. To tell the complete truth, he should have told Congress that they use particle beams, not lasers. But perhaps that would have been too embarrassing. After all, it was none other than Harold Brown's Livermore Laboratory that failed to develop a particle beam weapon. If Livermore Lab couldn't do it, neither could the Russians. All kinds of cover-up operations are now underway by the United States government to try to hide from the people what is really happening. For example, in AUDIO LETTER No. 27, I told you about the destruction of America's 85-ton space station known as Skylab. On October 18, 1977, a Soviet Cosmos interceptor blasted Skylab into a giant fireball that was seen by people along the path all the way from southwest Texas to Arkansas and Missouri. 9 days later, the cover-up began with government stories that Skylab is unexpectedly sinking toward Earth. And at the beginning of this month, the Skylab cover-up story was revived in such a way as to thoroughly confuse the public. Now we are told it looks as though Skylab may crash too soon for the space shuttle to save it. It may crash in late 1979, or then again it may crash by late this year. Pretending that Skylab is still up there, some NASA spokesmen say the engine should be fired to make it tumble slowly to keep it in orbit longer. Others say it should be made to tumble so it will come down sooner, say over the Indian Ocean. As I explained in AUDIO LETTER No. 26, the beauty of the Indian Ocean is that over long areas there are no witnesses to observe such things. While Soviet Cosmos interceptors were multiplying in Earth orbit in October, the Soviet manned moon program also started in a rush. On October 4, 1977, the 20th anniversary of Sputnik 1 was celebrated by launching Soyuz 25 from the same launch pad. As a cover story, Soyuz 25 was said to have returned to Earth after a few days, having failed to dock with Salyut 6 space station. But in fact, Soyuz 25 went on to make a manned landing on the Moon on October 16, 1977, landing on the far side in Jules Verne crater for reasons I explained in AUDIO LETTER No. 27. In the new Soviet Cosmos strategy, The massive deployment of men and equipment to the Moon was just the space age equivalent of a military deployment by airlift. The men, the spacecraft, the particle beam weapons, everything had been prepared for this giant military operation in space. And given the Soviet network of several major spaceports, which they call cosmodromes, launch rates unheard of in the United States were and are possible. Over the past 5 years, the Soviet Union has consistently launched satellites 6.5 times as frequently as the United States. And that is based only on those that the Soviet Union has reported so that they can be tracked by the West. There have been hundreds of secret launches of satellites that have never been positively detected or tracked in the West. During October and November, as I have detailed in previous tapes, the Moon was quickly converted into a military base of the Soviet Union. Today, there are 7 separate particle beam weapons installations on the near side of the Moon, plus a backup and supply base on the far side. And as I revealed in December, the lunar particle beam weapons have been test-fired at the Earth. In December, I also revealed that particle beam weapons were being fired in a defocused mode of operation off the East Coast, causing mysterious air booms called airquakes. These particle beam weapons are carried by floating platforms, which are not satellites in orbit. They can operate all the way from ground zero to altitudes of at least 800 miles. Normally, they stay high enough to be outside the atmosphere. These platforms, which use a principle known as electrogravitics, could have been developed long ago by the United States, but were not, and now we have no defense against them. When I say platform, I'm speaking in the military sense of a vehicle on which weapons are mounted. A naval ship is sometimes thought of as a gun platform. In the same way, an attack helicopter may be called a platform for the guns it carries. The Soviet floating particle beam platforms, according to my latest information, are actually spheres known as cosmospheres. As with the other aspects of the sudden, decisive Soviet leap into cosmostrategic weapons, the federal government is trying to keep a lid on the cosmosphere story. The White House is trying desperately to come up with some kind of story to explain those airquakes which have rattled nerves and broken windows. Within a few days, the Naval Research Laboratory is supposed to deliver a preliminary report explaining what the airquakes are. Every effort will be made to focus attention only on the East Coast, but airquakes are beginning to be heard elsewhere also, as other cosmospheres announce their presence. For example, at about noon Friday, February the 3rd, 2 airquakes were heard off the Texas Gulf Coast near Port Lavaca. There were 2 booms in quick succession heard over an area of 4 large counties. Then silence. The Coast Guard reported no aircraft on radar at the time, and there were no military aircraft in the vicinity. They were typical airquakes, my friends. The story was embargoed until 4 days later, Tuesday, and released only over the Texas wire of the Associated Press. As a result, they received no national publicity, and there have been and will be others around the country. When I recorded AUDIO LETTER 30 last month, the cosmospheres over the United States had all descended to relatively low altitudes, ranging from 15 to 60 miles. As of my latest report on February 23, they have climbed back up to more normal altitudes of around 400 miles, except for one over the Detroit area. This one, reported on that day to be at a height of 140 miles, was at a lower altitude earlier this month, and at that time there were many sightings around the Detroit area of an object that may well have been this cosmosphere. As I explained in Topic No. 3, foot dragging by our secret rulers in agreeing to surrender by means of SALT II is provoking once again an increase in Soviet acts of intimidation. For that reason, I think I should alert you to the latest locations of the Soviet cosmospheres over North America. The cosmosphere recently stationed over the Detroit area is the same one that formerly was over the Carolinas and caused many airquakes along the East Coast. Another is over the western Pennsylvania, West Virginia area. Another, formerly stationed in the vicinity of Quincy, Illinois, is currently over the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. There is a cosmosphere roughly over the Mississippi River, east of Little Rock, Arkansas. Another is over the Red River between Oklahoma City and the Dallas-Fort Worth area. A cosmosphere is hovering almost directly over NORAD headquarters in Colorado. Another is over Hoover Dam on the Nevada-Arizona border. And another is over the Glen Canyon Dam in northern Arizona. There is another over western Montana, and those over southern Alaska and just west of Hawaii are still on station. There is one new cosmosphere reported this month, located at last report over the waters between the southern tip of Florida and Cuba. When I recorded AUDIO LETTER No. 30 last month on the evening of January 28, I had just received word that the crew in capsule Cosmos 954, the killer satellite that had crashed in Canada, had been picked up by a Soviet cosmosphere previously stationed over Ottawa. I can now finish the story with the news that just before midnight that same night, Eastern Time, the cosmosphere landed in a wilderness area north of Lake Superior at coordinates 48, 18 north, 85, 42 west. There, the crew and capsule were transferred to a truck driven by Soviet agents, after which the cosmosphere departed. It's presently on station 212 miles north of Ottawa at an altitude of 300 miles. Needless to say, the search by Canadian and American teams for pieces of Cosmos 954 has no hope of ever turning up anything legitimate except auxiliary chunks of the satellite. Cosmos 954 was one of the two Soviet killer satellites which were operational when I record AUDIO LETTER No. 26. The other, launched last July, was Cosmos 929. Cosmos 929 was the first operational Cosmos interceptor satellite, and as I discussed in AUDIO LETTER No. 26, it destroyed an American spy satellite over Russia on September 20. Early this month, on February 2, Cosmos 929 fired its retrofire engines and re-entered the atmosphere over the Soviet Union, contrary to other published reports. Space operations in support of Soviet Cosmos strategy are continuing on all fronts. Progress 1, the space bus with 9 cosmonauts aboard that was described as a robust supply ship by Moscow, transferred supplies to Salyut 6 and then detached itself. Progress 1 is still in orbit, awaiting the next stage of the project of building a mammoth new space station in space. As I told you last month, Progress 1 is to become one part of the new space station, and on February 16, the cosmonauts on Salyut 6 accomplished another space first. They had started up an electric blast furnace which had been brought up by Progress 1, and the cosmonauts were to begin acquiring experience toward building large stations in space. A few days ago, Moscow correctly announced that the crew of Salyut 6 have also been busy observing, from their ringside seat in space, various weather phenomena and natural disasters. And no wonder, since geophysical warfare is also an operational part of the new Soviet Cosmos strategy. Beginning in AUDIO LETTER No. 24 last May, I've been warning about Soviet preparations to cause deliberate earthquakes and tidal waves as weapons of undeclared war. That month, I gave the navigational coordinates where 7 Soviet fission-fusion-fission superbombs had already been planted in strategic undersea locations around the Philippines. And a year ago this month, I referred to the fact that major Soviet experiments in weather modification were known to have been carried out on certain occasions. Last August, I revealed that cobalt bombs were being planted in the oceans as strategic locations to serve in a buildup of earthquake activity prior to the big catastrophe that awaits the Philippines and America's west coast, and I have revealed since then that some of these have been set off. Only recently I've been informed that some of the cobalt bombs have purposes other than earthquakes. In the North Pacific, 2 large warm water zones were discovered last fall. These warm water zones are pumping huge amounts of moisture into the air streams that sweep across America from the Pacific and creating tremendous air turbulence in the process. The result? Blizzards, high winds, and floods, which could very well affect our food supply in the near future. These hot water zones have been caused by the deliberate cracking of the seafloor to vent volcanic heat into the ocean. The center of one hot water zone thus created is located at 50-37-8 N, 170-32-51 E, near Attu in the Aleutians. The other is at 25-34-23 N, 151-18-41 W, between Hawaii and California. At both of these locations, Soviet cobalt bombs were planted and set off last summer. Last April, I alerted you that Soviet nuclear sabotage of the United States had begun, focusing at first on our dams and reservoirs. And last May, before suspending the AUDIO letter for 3 months in an all-out effort to expose and stop the mounting Soviet sabotage campaign, I told you of the Soviet strategy to use water against us as a weapon. Last month, a severe 2-year drought in California was broken by unrelenting torrential rainstorms. Now there is a threat of such heavy spring runoff that floods will be a problem instead of drought. And now, thanks to Soviet modification of America's weather, our major dams are being filled up just as they must be to produce maximum destruction when they are blown apart by Soviet nuclear mines.